What do Wall Street hedge funds, Ukrainian government officials, and Xbox gamers have in common today?
Well, aside from all of them probably having a headache right now.
Yeah, exactly. They are all, you know, waking up to realize that the fundamental rules of their digital worlds are just, they're being actively rewritten right out from under them.
Right. Entirely against their will in most cases.
Exactly. We are looking at a system where the rule book isn't just getting a software update. It's being entirely ripped apart by institutions and threat actors who frankly just understand the mechanics way better than everyday users do.
Oh, absolutely.
So if you are looking for the signal in all this noise, you are definitely in the right place. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are pulling all of our insights from the July 20, 2026 issue of Tekken Knight.
It's a fantastic issue too.
It really is. And our mission for this deep dive is to explore this incredibly messy, contradictory evolution of our digital lives. We're looking at how massive financial institutions, state-sponsored hackers, and corporate gaming giants are all desperately trying to engineer new ways to extract value, attention, and data from you.
Yeah, and we are tracing a very specific through line today. We are going to start with the high stakes, ideological and financial wars happening on the blockchain.
Right, where all that institutional money is basically trying to tame the decentralized network.
Exactly. Then we will pivot to look at how that exact same concept manipulating a system's core rules applies to modern cybersecurity. We'll look at how human psychology itself is being weaponized.
That part is terrifying, honestly.
It really is. And finally, we will land on how this strive for endless extraction is creating a massive existential crisis in the video game industry.
So let's jump right into that institutional takeover of the blockchain. It is happening so aggressively right now, especially with Grayscale.
Oh, Grayscale is making huge moves.
Right. The digital asset management giant just launched this new institutional fund that basically engineers a quarterly cash showdown between Ethereum and Solana.
Right.
They were battling for staking yields. And I mean, for anyone managing a traditional portfolio, this is a massive shift.
It's huge. And, you know, just to quickly clarify for anyone listening, staking in these proof of stake networks is essentially locking up your digital coins to help secure the network.
Like verifying transactions and stuff.
Exactly. And in return, the network programmatically pays you a yield. It completely replaces the old energy-intensive mining process.
It's kind of like a high-yield savings account, but for crypto.
That's a great way to put it. And Grayscale is now basically pitting the two biggest Layer 1 networks against each other, purely based on that yield.
The contrast between the two is wild, though. Like, Ethereum is the entrenched incumbent.
Right. It offers incredibly proven cryptographic security and vast decentralization.
But the trade-off is the network congestion and those notoriously high Layer 1 gas fees.
Right.
So the yield is stable, but it's lower.
Exactly. And then you have Solana, which approaches the whole blockchain trilemma from a totally different angle. It uses this hybrid proof of history consensus mechanism,
which makes it insanely fast.
Lightning fast speeds, near zero fees, which inherently drives up the staking rewards. But, you know, it sacrifices some decentralization and it definitely carries a history of catastrophic technical outages.
Right. The network just goes down sometimes.
Yeah. So Grayscale is basically calculating the real net yield of both networks every 3 months, adjusting the weight of the fund and distributing those profits to their investors.
But the mechanism of how Grayscale is actually doing this legally is the real story here. Because, I mean, the SEC has historically targeted third-party staking programs.
Oh, relentlessly.
Yeah, they usually classify them as unregistered securities offerings and just shut them down. But Grayscale seems to have completely outmaneuvered them this time.
Well, they are heavily leveraging the legal precedent they set during the spot ETF approvals a couple years ago. Instead of offering a direct staking service to retail users, which, you know, immediately triggers the SEC's Howey Test alarms, they structured this entire thing as a closed-end institutional trust.
Okay, so how does that bypass the SEC?
The trust holds the underlying assets, stakes them natively through regulated institutional custodians, and then captures that net staking yield as a dividend.
Oh, wow.
Because of this complex legal wrapping, they are essentially forcing the regulatory bodies to treat it as a traditional dividend-yielding trust rather than a raw crypto security.
That is some brilliant legal engineering.
It really is, and it's what opens the floodgates. We are looking at the potential for traditional finance, pension funds, sovereign wealth, major hedge funds to dump trillions of dollars into betting on Solana's uptime versus Ethereum's fee structure.
So literally, your retirement fund could quietly be relying on the network stability of a blockchain.
Exactly.
It feels like a high-stakes reality TV competition, but, you know, the prize is Wall Street's institutional capital. Whoever proves their architecture is more profitable just gets the billions.
That's exactly what's happening.
But wait, I have to ask. Doesn't this massive influx of traditional finance completely shatter the decentralized cypherpunk foundation of crypto? I mean, if BlackRock and Grayscale own the majority of the staked assets, corporate interests are suddenly the ones holding the leash on network upgrades, right?
It's the ultimate double-edged sword. It undeniably professionalizes the space, sure, but it also creates immense centralized pressure.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Like, core developers on Ethereum now have actual fiduciary pressure from Wall Street to optimize their fee markets.
Right.
And Solana engineers have to prove absolute bulletproof stability to these very conservative asset managers. The original ethos of building an alternative financial system is, well, it's being rapidly replaced by building a highly optimized backend for Wall Street's yield generation machine.
That's so wild. So while Ethereum and Solana are basically putting on a suit and tie to court Wall Street, Bitcoin is dealing with a massive internal ideological civil war.
Oh, it is a mess right now.
A total mess. It's a war over what a blockchain should even be allowed to process. And just to be super clear for you listening, we're looking at this purely to understand the mechanics of the debate.
Mm.
We are not taking sides on the underlying politics here.
Right. Impartial observers only.
Exactly. So Michael Saylor, the founder of MicroStrategy, has launched a really fierce attack on this new developer proposal called the blockchain cleanup.
Yeah, and the conflict stems from an unintended consequence of a previous network upgrade. A few years ago, the Taproot upgrade, combined with this technicality called the SegWit discount, allowed developers to create the Ordinals protocol and BRC20 tokens.
Okay, break that down for us.
Basically, by inscribing hexadecimal data into the witness signature of a transaction, users found a way to attach arbitrary data like NFTs, images, and text directly onto individual Satoshis.
So they basically figured out a loophole.
Exactly.
A loophole to store non-financial data on a network explicitly built for financial transactions.
Yes, and that has bloated the block sizes to their absolute limits. It's skyrocketing transaction fees and causing massive network congestion.
Which brings us to the two deeply entrenched camps in this civil war.
Right.
The classical developer view is that all this non-financial data is basically parasitic spam.
That's their argument. They say Bitcoin is engineered to be peer-to-peer electronic cash. When people in developing nations can't afford a transaction fee because, you know, someone in a Western country is minting a high-resolution image of a monkey onto the blockchain,
the network fails its primary utility.
Exactly. So the blockchain cleanup proposal aims to implement node-level filters to reject these specific data inscriptions and restore the block space for pure financial transaction.
But then Michael Saylor's coming out swinging against any kind of filtering whatsoever.
Yeah, his philosophical stance is rooted in absolute immutability and censorship resistance. He argues that a blockchain is a blank, open market. If you pay the transaction fee, you have the absolute right to write whatever you want to the ledger forever.
So he's looking at it as a slippery slope.
A very slippery slope.
Okay.
His warning is about moral authority. If a small group of core developers decides today that they have the right to filter out NFTs because they just deem them spam, then the network is no longer censorship resistant.
Right. Because tomorrow, under political pressure, that exact same mechanism could be used to filter out specific financial transactions from a sanctioned country or a dissenting political group.
Saylor argues that the moment you judge the utility of the data, Bitcoin loses its unique properties.
I mean, I understand the philosophical purity argument. I really do. But if the network is so congested that ordinary people literally cannot afford to send money, aren't the classical developers right from a purely functional standpoint?
It's a fair point.
Like, isn't it incredibly reckless to let digital art crash a global financial system just to prove a point about absolute freedom?
Well, that functional argument makes perfect sense until you look at the raw economic reality keeping the network alive right now.
What do you mean?
The network recently went through its programmatic halving event, right? Which slashed the block reward for miners by 50%.
Oh, right, the halving.
And miners are the ones who secure the network. Without them, the blockchain is vulnerable to 51% attacks. Those exorbitant fees generated by people minting ordinals have become a critical financial lifeline. They are replacing the lost block subsidies.
Oh, wow. So if developers implement the cleanup and ban ordinals,
they instantly devastate the miners' revenue stream, the hash rate drops, miners go bankrupt, and the fundamental security of the Bitcoin network plummets.
It is a brutal paradox. You either sacrifice the philosophical purity of the network by filtering data, or you risk the usability and security of the network by letting it bloat to a standstill.
Exactly.
It really just comes down to the struggle of defining what constitutes legitimate data versus malicious spam.
And that exact struggle to define legitimacy is perfectly mirrored in a terrifying new development in cybersecurity right now.
Oh, yeah. The UAC 0145 group.
Yes. But instead of hackers trying to bypass a blockchain filter, they have engineered a way to bypass the spam filters in our own brains.
It's wild. So the Hacker News report on this state-sponsored group, UAC 0145, details this campaign targeting Ukraine that completely weaponizes the systems we use to prove our human identity.
They are weaponizing the CAPTCHA.
Which is crazy because we've all seen this, right? Checking the box to prove you aren't a robot or finding all the crosswalks and bicycles in a grid.
Right. But UAC 0145 isn't just tricking people. They are fundamentally altering how the malware is actually delivered to the machine.
So how does the attack vector start?
It starts with highly sophisticated spear phishing. The emails are localized, flawless, and they target Ukrainian government officials or critical infrastructure workers. They masquerade as urgent military draft notices or tax alerts.
Something designed to trigger immediate panic.
Exactly. Panic bypasses logical scrutiny.
So you're panicked, you click the link. Now, usually that link initiates a suspicious executable file download, right?
That's the traditional method, yeah.
And modern endpoint detection and response software like your corporate antivirus would instantly flag it, isolate it, and block it because it recognizes the malicious file signature.
But UAC 0145 bypasses that entirely. The link takes the user to a pristine web page featuring a fake human verification system they've dubbed ClickFix.
And it looks legit.
It looks like a standard modern security check. It asks the user to prove they aren't a bot by dragging a slider across the screen or holding down a specific key combination, like a Windows shortcut.
And that physical interaction is the trap.
Yes.
But wait, how does dragging a web slider actually infect the computer without a download prompt?
It's because the web page is utilizing a malicious script tied to the user's clipboard and physical actions. By dragging that slider or hitting that specific key combination, the user is unwittingly executing a deeply obfuscated PowerShell command.
Oh, wow.
And it's hidden within the site's background code. It essentially leverages legitimate Windows administrative tools against the operating system itself.
So because it's a command executed via the user's own physical input, it just bypasses the browser's security sandbox completely.
Exactly. And the craziest part, it doesn't even write a file to the hard drive.
That is the most lethal aspect. The PowerShell command silently reaches out to a remote command and control server and downloads highly advanced fileless malware straight into the system's active RAM.
Right. And because there is no malicious file ever written to the physical hard drive, traditional signature-based antivirus scanners just look right past it.
Because they're scanning the disk. But the malware is operating entirely in the volatile memory.
Precisely. Once it is in the active memory, the hackers have full undetected root access. They can exfiltrate classified documents. They can scrape browser session tokens to steal passwords and just drain enterprise networks.
It is literally exactly like a burglar bypassing a multi-million dollar home security system by disguising themselves as the actual alarm keypad on your front porch.
That is a perfect analogy.
Yeah. You think you are typing in your code to secure the house, but the keypad itself is transmitting the unlock command to the deadbolt. It exploits what the report calls conditional trust and security fatigue.
We have so much security fatigue.
We do. We click these verification boxes dozens of times a day as a pure reflex. So how can everyday people possibly protect themselves when the very act of proving you are human is the attack vector?
It requires a complete retraining of our digital reflexes. Technically, enterprises can mitigate this by locking down PowerShell execution policies. But for the end user, the FAQ in the sources gives a very clear rule. Never trust a CAPTCHA that requires complex physical interactions.
That's a great tip.
Standard, safe CAPTCHAs rely on clicking a single box, selecting images, or typing distorted text, all within the browser element. If a verification page asks you to drag a bizarre slider, hold down keyboard shortcuts, or heaven forbid, copy and paste text into a command prompt, close the window immediately.
It is just exploiting your assumption of safety.
Exactly.
And, you know, that security fatigue. The endless, exhausting loops of verification and subscription just to simply exist online is bleeding heavily into the entertainment sector right now.
It really is. Gamers are experiencing severe live service fatigue, just as the major corporate publishers are deciding to abandon practically everything else.
Right. Microsoft and Xbox basically admitted this out loud in a highly controversial IGN interview with Matt Booty, the head of Xbox Game Studios.
Yeah, he urged the player base to, quote, stop fixating on traditional narrative-driven single-player games.
Which is a stark strategic pivot.
Very stark. But it is entirely driven by the underlying economics of modern game development. You look at Sony. Currently, Sony thrives on producing these high-budget, cinematic, single-player masterpieces.
Yeah.
However, the math required to produce those games has become totally unsustainable for Microsoft's specific business model. Developing a premier AAA game in 2026 takes anywhere from 5 to 7 years, and the budgets regularly exceed $250 million. You need massive teams for photorealistic asset creation, motion capture. It's just astronomical.
$250 million for one single game.
Right.
And for Xbox, that math fails entirely because they have bet their entire corporate ecosystem on the Xbox Game Pass subscription service, which, you know, costs players roughly $15 to $20 a month.
Exactly the problem. If Xbox spends $250 million on a brilliantly crafted 20-hour narrative experience, what happens? A subscriber is going to download it on a Friday, finish the amazing story by Sunday, and then cancel their subscription on Monday.
Right, because they beat it.
Exactly. A closed-loop narrative game does not sustain the recurring revenue economics required to keep a massive subscription service profitable. Their retention metric is just too low.
So their solution is to pivot into the assets they acquired when they bought Activision Blizzard.
Yep. They now own the biggest live service, continuous revenue franchises on the planet: Call of Duty, World of Warcraft, Overwatch.
They are basically mandated to build highly profitable online communities with battle passes and endless microtransactions.
That's the model. Now, to be fair to the reporting, Microsoft is still releasing some single-player games, like the Fable reboot.
Right.
But the overarching corporate strategy has definitively shifted toward infinite retention.
But, I mean, this logic feels incredibly cynical to me. It sounds like an open admission that artistic integrity, narrative closure, and modern corporate reality are totally incompatible. Are they really just sacrificing the fundamental soul of gaming to satisfy a quarterly recurring revenue spreadsheet?
Well, the massive backlash and the anti-live service hashtags that trended globally following the interview suggest the audience feels exactly that way.
People are just exhausted.
They are. Fans are exhausted by games that feel like second jobs, built around psychological drip feeds rather than compelling narratives. Furthermore, if a live service game fails to meet its revenue targets, the publisher just shuts down the servers and the game ceases to exist.
It's gone forever.
Gone forever. But to understand why Microsoft is terrified of that $250 million single-player gamble, we only need to look at the spectacular internal disaster that just hit Square Enix.
Oh, man. The Kingdom Hearts of leak.
Yes.
The massive leak reported by Kotaku perfectly illustrates the severe risk of modern AAA development. So a 15-minute cinematic video of a highly secretive, recently canceled prologue project codenamed Project Verum was just dumped onto the dark web and immediately spread all over Reddit and Twitter.
The leak showcased absolutely staggering photorealistic graphics rendered in Unreal Engine 5. It featured the protagonist, Sora, in this hyper-realistic, modern-day, Tokyo-inspired world called Quadratum.
And the lore analysts went crazy.
Oh, they immediately identified it as the resurrected concept of director Tetsuya Nomura's famously canceled passion project, Final Fantasy Versus 13.
So they spent years and millions of dollars building a massive playable teaser to bridge a convoluted story gap, and then Square Enix executives just axed the entire thing. Why scrap a project with that much time and money already sunk into it?
The project encountered severe technical bottlenecks. Optimizing Unreal Engine 5 for that level of photorealism across dynamic environments requires immense processing power and very aggressive asset management.
Which they couldn't do.
The team really struggled to achieve it at a stable frame rate. Combine those optimization failures with massive last-minute script rewrites demanded by the creative director, and the budget just began to spiral out of control.
So the executives just pulled the plug.
They cut their losses, canceled the standalone prologue, and forced the team to roll the completed assets into the main Kingdom Hearts 4 game.
But the real story here isn't even the cancellation. It's the sheer vulnerability of the industry. I mean, how does a 15-minute, completely uncompressed cinematic of a canceled, top-secret game leak to the public?
The sources point to a critical failure in internal IT security, specifically related to the modern hybrid and remote work models. You have developers working from home on personal networks, handling hundreds of millions of dollars in proprietary assets. The corporate enterprise security infrastructure, you know, the VPNs, endpoint management, data loss prevention protocols, it simply hasn't evolved fast enough to protect that data outside the physical office walls.
So it's basically user error at home.
A single compromised home router or a careless file transfer to a personal cloud drive bypasses all the expensive corporate firewalls.
It is the equivalent of a bank spending $100 million on a state-of-the-art titanium vault door, but leaving the blueprints on a remote worker's kitchen table.
That's exactly it.
They spent a fortune trying to manage this massive ambition, only to have it collapse under its own technical weight and then suffer this humiliating public breach. It makes you wonder if leaks of this magnitude will mark the end of remote work in the gaming industry. Will publishers enforce draconian security protocols and force developers back into lockdown, air-gapped corporate silos just to protect the IP?
Industry analysts expect exactly that. When a single file leak can disrupt a multi-million dollar marketing campaign, enrage the shareholders, and cause absolute chaos in management, corporate executives will inevitably pull the leash back in. The era of decentralized AAA game development is very likely closing.
Wow. Okay, so we have painted a fairly bleak picture of the digital landscape so far today.
Just a little bit.
Traditional finance is corporatizing the rebel spirit of the blockchain. State-sponsored hackers are weaponizing our daily security habits to inject fileless malware into our RAM. And massive gaming corporations are abandoning narrative art for live service subscription grinds while bleeding millions on bloated leaked projects.
It's heavy.
It is. But the sources do provide a powerful antidote to all of this hyper-capitalist bloat.
The surprise announcement of Neosphere of the Deep Blue Sky Legacy.
Yes. This completely broke the internet via Gematsu.
It did.
It's a passion project Japanese role-playing game. It's heavily focused on idealistic pilots, floating continents, ancient airships, and pure narrative. But what is truly brilliant about it is the release strategy. The developers are explicitly refusing to chase that $250 million photorealistic dragon. They're launching on PC and the aging Nintendo Switch.
Which is so smart. Launching on the Switch in 2026 is a masterclass in market positioning. The hardware is widely considered obsolete in terms of raw processing power, sure, but it boasts staggering active install base of over 130 million users.
That's a massive audience.
Massive! The developers of Neosphere understand a fundamental truth that Microsoft and Square Enix seem to have just forgotten. Mid-budget, or AA, games do not need Unreal Engine 5 photorealism to be wildly successful.
They just need next-gen cel-shaded art, sweeping fully orchestrated soundtracks, deep turn-based combat, and a story that actually has an ending.
Imagine that.
Right. It thrives perfectly on older hardware, because the artistic direction carries the weight, not the processing power. I mean, it's like finding a brilliantly written, beautifully shot indie film playing right next door to a massive, exhausting Marvel blockbuster. It proves you do not actually need $250 million to capture people's hearts.
Synthesizing the sources today reveals that technology in 2026 exists in a profound, messy paradox. On one end of the spectrum, you have immense bloat and extraction. Financial institutions are engineering complex legal trusts to extract yield from decentralized networks.
Right.
Hackers are engineering elegant ways to extract data by turning our conditioned reflexes against us. And corporate giants are aggressively discarding traditional art in favor of systems designed to extract endless subscription fees.
It's all about extraction.
Yes. Yet, in the margins of all that heavily engineered bloat, pure artistic creativity, functional storytelling, and mid-budget ambition still find a way to thrive by deliberately ignoring those new rules.
It is a massive paradox. And it leaves me with this final thought for you to ponder. We are seeing these massive digital ecosystems, whether it's Wall Street's blockchain yield machines, global cybersecurity warfare, or the endless grind of live service gaming, become incredibly complex, hyper-expensive, and frankly, exhausting to participate in.
Absolutely exhausting.
So as these megasystems continue to demand more of your money, your data, and your cognitive load, will we eventually see a mass exodus? Will everyday users migrate entirely back to retro, offline, or localized systems just to reclaim their peace of mind? If the game board keeps getting flipped, eventually people might just walk away from the table. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, and keep questioning the digital world around you.